The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Jeff.
Blog Talk Radio.
Shalom. This is Richard Address, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you again to today's installment of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows represent our desire to explore issues and events that help shape and comment on the current revolution in longevity and how that revolution is impacting our families, ourselves, and our Jewish world at large. We invite you to share comments and ideas with us at Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com or on our Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page, which we just created in we invite you to go to Facebook and like the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio page. We'll be commenting on upcoming shows and updating you on guests, et cetera, on that particular page. And if you'd like to be a part of the conversation, we invite you to jot down this phone number and call in. Producer Steve will be happy to greet you and place you in the queue. The call-in number is 646-668-8763. That's 646-668-8763. And we'll be going to the West Coast in a little bit, waiting on our guest, Rabbi Ann Brenner. She's going to be joining us today to talk about the 25th anniversary edition of her very, very powerful and popular book, Mourning and Mitzvah. It's a guide, a guided journal for walking the mourner's path through grief to healing. And we're waiting for Rabbi Brenner to get on the phone with us. The question really, it really kind of like follows up on some of the conversations we had last week with Rabbi Raphael and Rabbi Levin on the changing nature in many cases of mourning practices that we're seeing across the Jewish community. And want to explore some of that with her. One of the other things that we got involved with, and one of the other things that we hope to do here on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio, is bring you a series of commentaries from various numbers of contributors who have written for us on the homepage, JewishSacredAging.com. And we had one of our columnists last week, Sandy Taradash, call in. She writes a regular column called Baby Boomer Bubby on JewishSacredAging.com. And we've invited Rabbi Jeff Salkin from Florida to also be one of our regular contributors. These are going to be individuals who volunteered to offer some thoughts and opinions on some things that they're working on and aspects that touch areas of our own baby boomer life and longevity and impact of longevity on our families. So Jeff will be offering really some commentary around this concept that he's calling the Jewish clock. And so we're going to start today with Jeff's commentary because it's very timely in many cases. He writes a blog, Martini Judaism, and he will invite you. He'll give you the information on that. And so we want to welcome to today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging, today's commentary segment with Rabbi Jeff Salkin from Hollywood, Florida.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Jeff Salkin. I am the senior rabbi of Temple Solel in Hollywood, Florida, and I welcome you to the first in an exciting new series, and that is My Theological Clock is Ticking, Being Jewish in Our 60s. We're going to talk about Jewish identity as we reach the age of 60 and beyond, and in so doing, we are going to touch upon the historical and cultural moments that shaped our lives. I've been looking back recently at the last 50 years. I've been thinking about the fact that this is the 50th anniversary of one of the most important one-word quotes in cinematic history, and that is the word plastics. And it comes to us from the movie The Graduate, which came out in 1967. Now, you're probably saying that there's nothing very Jewish about The Graduate because none of the characters were Jewish, but I would actually submit to you that Ben Braddock, the alienated graduate, could have been Ben Bronstein. Mrs. Robinson could have been Mrs. Rubinstein. The Graduate was a totally Jewish movie. I want you to remember the film with me. Remember that Ben is a product of Southern California's upper middle class. He has just graduated from college. He doesn't know what he wants out of life. And at his graduation party, he says to his father, "I'm just worried about my future. I want it to be different." And then a few moments later, a family friend approaches him and says, "I want to say one word to you, just one word. Are you listening?" And the word that we're talking about comes next: plastics. I think that is perhaps the single most important one-word line in cinematic history. Now, if you're of a certain age, that is to say, if you are in your early 60s, and you remember that we used the word plastic a lot in the late 60s and early 1970s to describe people, and it was not a compliment. If you said that someone was totally plastic, you were saying that that person was artificial, or that that person was someone who could twist himself or herself into being whatever others thought he or she should be. And I want to suggest to you that that is no way to live. I'm thinking of a great Hasidic Rebbe, Rabbi Mordechai of Lechowitz, and he was once invited to attend the bris, the ritual circumcision of a friend's son, and the friend asked him, "Rebbe, would you bless my son? Would you impart some life wisdom to my son?" I want you to imagine what the Rebbe did not say to that newborn child. He did not say plastics. No, the Rebbe said these words to the infant and to all those who were there: "May you not fool God, may you not fool yourself, and may you not fool people." Some of you might be familiar with the wildly popular musical Hamilton. We meet Alexander Hamilton as a young man, New York City, 1776. It is his first encounter with Aaron Burr, the man who would ultimately kill him in a duel. The young Hamilton establishes a commonality with Aaron Burr. They are both orphans. The young Hamilton wants to join the revolution. He wants to devote his life to a cause that goes beyond himself. And so what does Aaron Burr do? He offers Hamilton some free advice: talk less, smile more, don't let them know what you're against or what you're for. And I submit to you that if you've reached this age and if you've reached this stage in life, you know that this is no way to live. It is no way to live because we cannot live in a way in which no one knows what we are against or what we are for. So how do we cure this problem of plastics? The answer is also in The Graduate. If you go back to the first scene, even before the family friend advises him on plastics, what does Ben Braddock want to be? What does he want from his life? What does he want from his future? Wants to be different. And that is the key to authenticity, to know that each of us is different because this is built into our spiritual DNA. God creates us, each of us made in God's image. We are simultaneously created, very much the same and yet very different. Our uniqueness and our sanctity does not emerge from our wealth or from our profession or from our IQ or from what college we went to or didn't go to or from our address or from where we vacation or from what kind of car we drive or what kind of parties we have. Our uniqueness, our specialness comes from one place and one place only. And this is the greatest teaching there is in Judaism, that we are all made in the divine image. So I want you to understand that. The answer to life, and we know this when we come to this moment in our lives, is the blessing of our own uniqueness, not to be plastic, that we can make a difference. I will tell you this, Judaism will not make you beautiful. It will not make you popular. Judaism will teach you how not to be plastic. Judaism can, at any stage of life, and certainly at this stage of life, teach you the core of who you are. Judaism will teach you that it is fine to be different, because as a people, we Jews have a different set of values and we have a different way of looking at the world, and Judaism will teach you, and at this stage of life, you need to hear this, not only to be different, but to make a difference. You have to matter to people. You have to matter to yourself. You have to matter to your family. You have to matter to your people and to your community. It's not plastics. It's about being different and making a difference. So this is the first installment in our series, My Theological Clock is Ticking, Being Jewish at 60. As I said, I'm Rabbi Jeff Salkin, senior rabbi of Temple Solel in Hollywood, Florida. You can also read my blog, Martini Judaism, for those who want to be shaken and stirred, which is published by the Religion News Service. We talked about plastics. Join us again next time as we move into another moment in those sacred occasions that shaped our lives. Shalom.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Welcome back to today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Rabbi Jeff Salkin from Hollywood, Florida, and his Jewish Clock is Ticking commentary, and we'll hear more from him later on a regular basis, we hope. And right now we welcome from far across the continent, as the sun is rising in beautiful Los Angeles, Rabbi Ann Brenner. Are you there, Ann? Hello? Well, here we go. The joys of technology.
She should be with us.
We're trying to get her.
We'll get her back on the phone. I'll work with her.
Okay. In the meantime, while our producer Steve tries to get her, we're having some phone issues back and forth across the continent. We're going to be talking with Rabbi Brenner about mourning and mitzvah. Couple of the things we want to talk to her about, not only is the 25th anniversary of the book, why, you know, the exploration of mourning and the mitzvot and the rituals, a custom that surround the death and bereavement practices in our tradition are fascinating and continue to evolve in many ways. But I also want to explore with her what she's seeing as she speaks about this and teaches this in the changes, some of the changes that are taking place. As I know, as I travel around the country, and you know, I was just in Northern California recently, and in Los Angeles recently, and in Canada recently with congregations. And we actually, in each one of these venues, this subject came up about some of the changes and practices that are now being influenced within the Jewish community. And it's kind of interesting because, even at a funeral directors conference that I spoke at in April in Nashville, there was a conversation we had in the Q&A on the rise of cremation, for example. And in each venue, each congregation in each city that I've been to in the last year or two, this situation seems to be getting more popular. The rabbi I was working with over this past weekend in Northern California said, yeah, he also is doing some increasing numbers of cremations. It's just part of this change. It's not so subtle change that's taking place. A lot of it being driven by economics, and a lot of it, you know, being driven by the baby boom generation looking for different avenues and venues. So let's see. I hear the sacred barking of a dog. So let's see if Ann is on the phone. Ann, are you there?
I'm here. Yes, I am.
Hi.
How are you?
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. It's a beautiful day here in Southern California.
Well, we're live. Welcome to Jewish Sacred Aging Radio, and I appreciate you getting up so early. It's the crack of dawn out there in L.A.
It's not that early, but I'm happy to be here.
I'm sure the 405 is already backed up over the pass.
Well, I don't know. I don't have to drive that much, so.
Good for you. Lucky you. Lucky
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're talking about your book, Morning and Mitzvah, and the 25th anniversary edition of it, subtitled A Guided Journal for Walking the Mourner's Path Through Grief and Healing. So, and let's get this out of the way. First of all, this is available all over the place, Amazon. It's published by Jewish Lights. If somebody wants to get a hold of it, how do they do that?
Well, I think Amazon is the best and probably the best deal as well. It's published by Jewish Lights, but Jewish Lights is now an imprint of Turner Publishing, so it could be found either through Turner Publishing, Jewish Lights Publishing, or Amazon. I guess the important thing to remember is either the name of the book or that Anne has an E and Brenner has one N.
and your website is, you have your own website, right?
No, I don't. I know I probably should. I had one once, and somehow it disappeared. But I can be reached if people would like to reach me. Just remember the spelling of my name, Annebrenner, and you can track me down.
Okay, so the great God Google can probably find you.
Right.
So talk to me about the genesis of the revision. What led you to revise this book? I mean, morning practices, have they changed that much in 25 years? What was the deal here?
Well, I think the zeitgeist has changed in the last 25 years. I think people are a lot more comfortable talking about aging, as you have made such a contribution in that field, talking about death, talking about spirituality. And so I wanted to be able to add some of the things that I'd learned, some of the things that I felt were more representative of where we are today. Clearly, the Jewish mourning practices remain the same, and they're as solid and wise today as they were hundreds of years ago. But I understand them in a way that I think is more that people can hear better now than they could 25 years ago. I think that there's a lot of practices in the Jewish mourning practices that are the intention of them is spiritual in a way that people perhaps weren't so comfortable talking about before. I wanted to be able to address that, and also it felt like an honest thing to do because I kept growing, I kept changing, my understanding of grief kept growing, and I wanted to be able to factor what I'd learned into the book.
What was the biggest change in you over these 25 years?
Well, the Jewish mystics talk about mochin de katnut and mochin de gadlut. They talk about the small contracted mind and the expansive mind. And I think that my understanding of grief has grown from having it be very specifically addressing a situation, a person who's lost, something very much about my own personal pain, or the pain of someone with whom I'm working, to evolving into recognizing that this is that the grief that we feel is the way of the world, that everyone goes through this, that this is a universal issue, that the feelings that are brought up by grief are universal feelings that must be felt if we're to understand what it means to be human on a planet where living things die. And so I wanted to be able to address it not just from the personal, but also from a more universal. I also wanted to encourage people to understand that the feelings that we have when we're grieving are not going to last forever if we allow ourselves to feel it. And so what I did was look at grief through the window of the holiday of Sukkot. Sukkot being a time when we are commanded to live in very fragile, temporary dwellings, and to look at each stage of grief as something that you are in some ways commanded to go through. You must learn to feel this feeling, but it's not going to last forever. So what I did was I took the stages of grief that everybody is so familiar with and to reframe them in such a way that there was no sense that any of the stages had any pathology involved. Certainly depression is not really an appropriate name for a stage of grief. There's a period of intense sadness, but to give it a label that is actually a psychiatric diagnosis seems really unfair to people who are suffering. And many of the other words that we usually associate with grief also have sort of a negative valence. So I wanted to take each stage of grief, frame it as a Sukkot, a place that we are commanded to live, but only temporarily, and then to give each of these stages a very, very holy Hebrew name to indicate that we are learning very holy things about being human, that in fact our relationship with God is also something that is evolving, or our relationship with holiness, and to create literally a Sukkot in which that evolution could take place, both with regard to a personal loss, a very specific personal loss, as well as the need to really reframe our relationship with God, with holiness, and with the universe.
So these Sukkot, you have a whole, just as you said, the theme runs through the book. This Sukkot of mourning, you also, I think, use also this concept of the Sukkah of transformation, that this is the fragility concept, the metaphor of the Sukkah, fragility of life, but is also as a means of transformation of a person. Could you just walk me through that a little bit? Because
in the ancient Hebrew blessing from the time of the temple down to the blessing that we use today for mourners, the blessing calls God Hamakom, which means the place. Mm-hmm. And I think that the wisdom in that is so profound because it allows mourners to seek, and encourages mourners to seek a place of comfort rather than to imagine God as one way or the other. It allows that relationship to be defined according to the needs of the mourner. What is it that you need to experience? What is it that you need to feel? What will actually bring you comfort? And then allowing that comfort, that place of comfort, to be defined as God. So what I've done with the Sukkah, I mean, I've conceived of grief as a wilderness. A wilderness in which we live in these temporary dwellings that we call Sukkot. Wilderness, as I'm sure you know, is a word that in Hebrew, the Midbar, the wilderness, that word has the same root letters as the words for speaking. And I think that it is a statement that it is in the wilderness of grief that we must literally come to terms and find the words that will help us create the Makom Hanachem, the place, the holy place of healing and comfort that the ancient blessing speaks of. So what I've tried to do is to create Sukkot. Actually, it isn't in the book. If you came to my office, you could see it, or I have it on a PowerPoint if someone would like to bring me in to show it. But I've created little tiny Sukkot made out of doll furniture to demonstrate what the experience is in each of these Sukkot. The experience being a different emotion that has to be, that people need to feel and that needs to be validated and then also needs to be given a holy name. As I said, depression is so unfair. What I call that stage of grief, which is so painful and so sad, I use the word kavod. Kavod in Hebrew means honor, but it also means weight and gravitas. And rather than call this stage depression, I think of it as a place where we're just feeling the intensity, the gravitas, the weight of grief, and we need to take the time to honor what has been lost, who has been lost, the process of change. In the Torah, when Moses is begging God, saying, please let me see your presence, what he says is, please let me see your kavod. Please let me see the part of you that is tangible. And that yearning that Moses expresses is the yearning that mourners feel when they're in this stage. Let's call it by something that's holy, so that mourners will be encouraged to have the experience, because once we have these experiences, we learn a lot about what it means to be human. We become less afraid of the inner world and its turmoil. We begin to understand what it takes to get through these, and we have a whole lot more confidence in who we are, and we take life a whole lot more seriously. I think that the denial of death that people feel, or that so pervades our culture, where we pretend that things will last forever, we can dump things into the oceans can handle it. We have such a culture of denial, and I think that we're in great peril because of this. So allowing ourselves,
go ahead, finish up here.
Allowing ourselves to feel all these feelings breaks through the denial, makes the experience of grief so much less frightening, and teaches us, as I said before, what it means to be human on a planet where we're always living in temporary dwellings, where we never know what life is going to bring. So grief is one of the tools that we're given to enable us to come to terms with the fact that things change, and to build the resilience and the spiritual musculature for confronting our impermanence, our transitory nature.
We're speaking with Anne Brenner, of Morning in Mitzvah, the 25th anniversary edition. It's just been published, and Rabbi Brenner is available, as she just alluded to, for speaking engagements. And you can Google her to contact her. The book is available, obviously, on Amazon. And if you want to chime in with Rabbi Brenner on this conversation, the number is 646-668-8763. That's 646-668-8763. And you alluded to the denial of death. I've just again finished just reading on another airplane the biography of Erwin Yalom, who lives up the up the 101 from you in Palo Alto. And he's been a pioneer in really bringing this concept of death anxiety out into the open. You've been working in this field, obviously, for so long, and the book. Have you noticed a greater acceptance on the part of, let's say, baby boomers and Jewish people, Jewish baby boomers, of our own sense of our own finitude? Have we begun to overcome this, or is there still, when push comes to shove, a great denial?
Well, I mean, I think the answer is yes and no. I mean, certainly there is more comfortable discussion about grief and about death. There's this phenomenon of which I'm sure you're aware called death cafes, where people get together and they talk about their concerns about death, maybe some of the plans they need to make in terms of their own burial, their own funeral, all of that. So I think that the conversation is a lot more comfortable for a lot more people. But I think that the culture of denial, as I alluded to earlier, just pervades our culture. And I think it has led us to take a lot of things for granted that that really are very fragile. I mean, I think we see it in terms of the political world right now, where we certainly have always taken democracy and freedom of the press and so many of the things that feel threatened right now, we've taken those, we've just thought that they were permanent. We didn't realize that they were fragile and had always had to be tended to. I think that certainly in terms of our natural world and our environmental issues, this denial has just, I mean, I think we're in great peril as a result of it. I just saw something where there's two square miles of plastic garbage in the Caribbean. And I know there's much more than that in the Pacific. But it's just, let's just throw it away. There's plenty of room. We can't absorb it. Everything that we treasure is fragile and needs to be tended. And I think that that's a basic understanding in Judaism. Certainly the sukkah is a metaphor, and the holiday of Sukkot is a metaphor for that, because it is both this time when we live in these fragile dwellings, and it's Zman Simchatenu, it's the time of our great joy. So that, to me, is one of the great spiritual teachings of Judaism. Life is fragile. Let's celebrate. I mean, it's just brilliant.
In picking up on that, you in the book, I think, allude to an allusion of Psalm 30 when you say you're going to turn mourning into dancing, which seems sort of like counterintuitive. But really, what do you mean by that?
I could speak forever, and you might have to have me on again to talk about that, because that psalm is attributed to King David, and it is said that he wrote that to be read as part of the dedication of the temple, and which of course he didn't get to participate in, but the words that he used both for mourning and for dancing, they just don't translate into English in the way that he intended. In Hebrew, for example, there are about 11 words for dancing in the Bible, and they can mean all kinds of different things. This one in particular that he chose in the psalm is mahal. Mahal is a word that really means a ritual dance. A ritual healing dance, often performed in circles by women. The women who crossed the Sea of Reeds perform and celebrated after they were released from slavery, they danced a mahal. So what it's saying is not I'm going to go from abject misery to total delight. It's saying that I'm going to learn the rituals of healing. I'm going to learn how grief is choreographed, and how healing is choreographed. And my belief is that that was his intention, that the temple, that his vision of the temple was that it should be a place of healing, where people learn the practices, the spiritual practices that would bring healing. And there's also, it says in I think it's in the Talmud, where it says that King Solomon said, oh no, this is actually the description of his dedication of the temple. He said, may anyone who suffers, please, may they come here. May they come here with their suffering. And so we're told that when the temple stood, there was a special path that mourners walked, and it was a circular path, so it's kind of like that mahol, that circular ritual dance, and they would come in through this special gate and walk along this path, and then those who were not walking the path would greet them with the blessing to which I alluded before, Hamachom Yenachem, may the one who dwells in this place bring you comfort. The one who dwells in this place being God, of course. And what's so interesting is that it was referred to as the mourner's path, but what the people who walked it were not just the people that we usually think of as mourners. In fact, it was people whose financial status had changed, whose role in the community had changed, people who were dealing with illness. So, in fact, just about everybody would have been walking that path.
I mean, you used the concept choreography. I think it's a really interesting image to play with, because there is a certain sense of choreography to the Jewish mourning rituals. Is there not? I mean, from the moment of death through the burial, through Shiva, through Shloshim, through the year, there is this choreography.
I think that's totally true, and I think it's a choreography that involves both the people who are grieving as well as the people who are providing comfort, how close they come, how much they're supposed to speak, how much they're not supposed to speak, when they say Amen, when they stand, when they don't stand. All of that is part of the choreography of grief and learning these the steps of this dance. And I love to think of it as a dance, because when it's a dance, it means it can change. It means that there's movement. I think that so often when we speak of grief, we talk about something as if it is just a intractable, solid, dark, just impenetrable. And so when we think of it as a dance with different nuances, different Sukkot in which to live, where we have a different experience each time, it begins to be something that moves. In the Song of Songs, there's a line that I just love. It says, our little sister, is she a wall or a door? And, of course, most people have a Freudian interpretation of what that means, having to do with, is she a virgin or not? But I think that we need to think of life and every obstacle that we encounter. Is it a wall or is it a door? And so when we think of it as a dance, it becomes more of a door. It becomes something that you can move through. When we think of it as a wall, it feels like we can never possibly get through it.
One of the rituals that really, to pick up this image that you're using, is maybe viewed as one of the most important or most powerful doorways is the vidui, is the confessional. Could you talk to us a little bit about the power of that, of the vidui, and what vidui is?
Well, the vidui is a prayer that is, oh, my dog is going to start barking. Hold on, let me move away. It's technically a prayer that when we think of the vidui, we think of it being recited on the deathbed. But in fact, it's a prayer that we recite a version of, certainly on Yom Kippur, but also every night before we go to sleep. There's a a Talmudic line that says that we should repent the day before we die. And, of course,
right.
the question is, when is that going to be? Well, I better repent every day just to be on the safe side. The way that I have seen the Vidui, which the one that is said on the deathbed is that I see it as having various qualities that that help people review their lives, assess who's important and what is their legacy that they want to leave to that person, their spiritual legacy. To those people, and then to explore what is it that I believe is going to happen to me. One of the last lines is, "Into your hands I put my soul," and so it sort of challenges people to ask the mysterious question about where am I going. Which, by the way, getting back to something that you asked earlier, I think that people are a lot more open to exploring that great mystery. And I hesitate to try to map that mystery, but I think it is essential for people to wonder, is this all there is? I mean, in terms of sacred aging, I feel like one of the most important things that I can do as I get older is to switch my identification with the parts of me that are matter to the parts of me that are soul. And there's a lot more if you just look at how matter is constructed, and there's a lot more soul space in our bodies than there is actual physical matter. So I think that the Vidui gives us one tool for thinking about where we're going and what is our true identity, and allowing that identity to not just be the concrete things that we understand ourselves to be, or the concrete acts that we do on the earth, but to really open to our spiritual selves and the parts of ourselves, as you know, and I'm sure has been said many times on your show, the word for soul and the word for breath in Hebrew are actually several words for souls and soul, and several words for breath or wind have the same roots. And so that sense that we fill with breath, we fill with wind, we fill with the great soul, and it fills up much more of our body than the thin tissues that hold it. So in exploring our finitude, in saying a Vidui really every night, we allow ourselves to sort of drift off into that place where we're more identified with soul than with body. And I think it's a very good choice at a time when we're facing the fact that we're getting older and we're not going to live forever.
So, Anne, as an author, as a therapist, as a rabbi, what do you believe? Where does the soul go?
You know, I don't know, and I'm okay with that. I think that anybody who tells you that they know exactly where the soul is going, I think you should run from that person. I think that one of the most important things that we can learn as beings on this planet is to have comfort about the fact that we don't know most of the things that exist in the universe. And perhaps one of the things that we most cannot know is the nature of God or holiness. I mean, one of the things I like to tell my students is that we have, you know, 5, 6, 7, maybe 8 senses, 8 different channels through which we perceive reality. There's probably lots more that we don't even have a clue about. And so how could we possibly understand or claim to understand the nature of the universe, which is so vast? So a lot of the spiritual journey and the spiritual challenge is to make peace with the fact that we don't know, but to always be curious. I think maybe the most one of the prime tools that will help us make peace with our finitude, make peace with the things that we cannot know, is the fact that we remain curious. That we're always wondering, that we're always open to the possibility that there's something that we don't know, and to seek that thing, even though we know that it's illusory that we could ever really come to a place of fully knowing.
The again, we're speaking with Rabbi Ann Brenner, rabbi, author, therapist, revised and honored the 25th anniversary edition of Morning in Mitzvah. Available on Amazon and mourning is very personal. I don't think there's any one paradigm for it. In my experience as a rabbi, people go through it in their own way. Often, you know, based upon really how they even grew up and their own family of origin issues. But looking over your career, and you worked on this, and you revised the book, you studied this in the tradition.
As well as my own losses and what I've learned from my own personal experience.
As we all do. Has there been or are you noticing? Let me put it this way: are you noticing changes in the way our community practices mourning rituals? As we were saying before you came on the phone, I seem to be picking up in my travels around the country a diminution of people's desire to hold firm to all the mourning rituals and traditions for convenience sake or for a variety of reasons. Are you noticing this a change in the way our community mourns and grieves dealing with loss?
Well, you know, I think that there's many different enclaves in the community, and people are doing many different things. Overall, and I think that that we're particularly aware of it in the last year. We live in a culture that does not affirm the sacred. Does not take the time to savor the sacred. And I think that the Jewish mourning rituals and the fact that they are protracted not just over the first month or year, but over the lifetime, really, says that that they're really determined to slow us down to recognize the sacredness and the value and the beauty in just about every breath that we take, if we can do it with gratitude and recognizing the awe. In the book, when I conceived of the Sukkot, I used the word, the Hebrew word for awe, as the name of both the first sukkah and the last sukkah, because in Hebrew and particularly in mystical Jewish understanding, there's awareness that there are two faces of awe. One is a face of fear, and the other is a face of reverence. And the mourning rituals are an attempt to guide us from that time of great fear when we are initially visited by loss, which is often called denial, but it's not that at all. It's about, wow, you know, what has just happened? Every cell has to learn a whole new way of being in the world. All of our assumptions are shattered. It's a terrifying time. So what's happened in the world is that we meet that terrible time, that frightening time, that time of what Kabbalists would call lower awe, and the fear makes us contract, and so we don't allow ourselves to go through all of the different Sukkot, all of the different experiences of grief that force us to slow down, force us to pay attention, force us to see each of these things as sacred, and brings us to the final sukkah, which is also named awe, but it's awe that also has in it the word hoda'ot, which means gratitude and praise and reverence for, Abraham Joshua Heschel spoke of higher awe as radical amazement, and
right.
I think that we live in a culture that doesn't allow us to do the dance, take the steps, walk through the Sukkot, and dwell in the Sukkot until we learn the tools that turn our awe that is based in fear into an awe of amazement. Certainly not acceptance. It's pretty hard to say, okay, I'm okay with that now when something terrible has happened. But we recognize that we are still here, that we have learned something that we wouldn't have learned, that perhaps our relationship with God or with what we see as holy has been transformed, and we move to, I don't know that I've really totally addressed your question, but what I'm trying to say is that I think that our morning rituals are designed to teach us the importance of seeing each step that we take through the world as a sacred step, as a sacred
right.
journey.
And it's like that Alvin Fine poem, Birth is a Beginning and Death is a Destination. And it is a holistic approach. One of the things before we start running out of time, and we're going to do that real soon, that I wanted to just make sure that you mentioned, because one of the I think very attractive parts of the book, other than walking you through interpretations of this choreography of grief and mourning from the Jewish tradition, is you include exercises. Give me an example. I mean, what are these exercises in this book designed to do?
Well, the attempt is to, and I think that this is the nature of all ritual, is to create a place, and I'll use that word again in Hebrew, a makom, which is a name of God, in which transformation can happen. And I think each ritual kind of focuses us so that something can happen. So what I've done is create a lot of rituals that are usually writing rituals, although there are other things as well, where people are asked to dwell with a certain feeling or a certain question or a certain issue, and then explore it. And in the exploring, I mean, the exploring is a dance that then takes them into another place, and that's what we're always looking for, the sweet spot that will. I like to always quote the Bob Dylan song, "Knock knock knocking on heaven's door," and so when we're mourning, we're knock knock knocking on heaven's door. Very often, we're saying, "Why? How? Why me? Why them?" And then all of a sudden, we hit a sweet spot. The question is never really answered, but suddenly the world gets bigger. And we dwell in a more vast place that can hold the paradoxes of life, that bad things happen to good people and vice versa, and that we can experience both abject sadness and radical amazement at the same time. So you asked for a specific example, and one that I'll just grab quickly is that I know that a lot of people have used in other ways is writing letters to the deceased, or writing letters to the situation that has changed. And I use that in the earlier part of the book, not the epilogue, which has to do with these understandings of Sukkot, but I use that as part of saying Kaddish, because when we say Kaddish, we say it first. It's just we stand in a place, and it gives us a place to stand when we don't know where, how to put one foot in front of the other. And people are supposed to surround us and say amen. And it's as if with their amen, they're tethering us to the earth and enabling us to go to the mysterious unknown place where healing comes. But then the Kaddish is also I used to say, I don't know what the right metaphor would be today. I used to say fiber optic connection between the worlds, and then I said wireless connection between the worlds. But it's an opportunity to say all the things that we didn't get to say that perhaps couldn't be said because of the nature of people's defenses. So the Kaddish becomes a connecting point between the worlds where we can continue the conversation, which is such an important task in grief. We have to believe that the conversation can continue because if we say, well, I can't say that now, I've lost my opportunity, then we shut down a part of ourselves that dwelled in the conversation that we had with somebody else, and we cease to grow. So one of the very challenging and tricky parts of grief is finding where you are in that conversation and then being able to continue it in such a way that your physical connection with someone you've lost becomes a spiritual connection. And when you can achieve that, it doesn't mean that there won't be times when you physically miss them, but you do have them as a companion for the rest of your life. And I think that the Jewish rituals give us many, many different opportunities, even beyond the first year, to continue that conversation and focus it through Yisker, through Yahrzeit. And I could really say a lot more about that, but I think we're running out of time.
Yeah, and you're right. They're the opportunity, and I think once you walk the walk, as you've alluded to, that these people who we love are always with us, and we constantly visit and invite them into our lives continually. So we've been speaking with Rabbi Dan Brenner, the author of Morning in Mitzvah, the 25th anniversary edition. Mazel tov on that, Ann, and really with best of luck with this.
Thank you.
Available through Amazon, published by Jewish Lights, an imprint of Turner Publishing. And you can contact Anne, and it's Annebrenner. You can Google her, and she's available also, as she's alluded to, for speaking engagements and scholar-in-residence work. And Anne, thank you for joining us here on today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. I really do appreciate it. I hope the dog's okay.
I think that the healing comes when we can understand our lives as a spiritual journey. And I think that the rituals, the choreography of grief allows us to learn how to do that dance.
Thank you. Thank you all for being a part of today's broadcast of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows are archived as podcasts on both Blog Talk Radio and our website, jewishsacredaging.com. Again, we invite your comments and suggestions to rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com or go to our Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page, and we'll enjoy your comments on that. These shows are produced at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media here in beautiful Cherry Hill, New Jersey, under the control of Steve Lubetkin. Thank you for listening. We look forward to greeting you again on the next edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Richard Address. Thank you, and shalom.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at HeftyRenew.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.